God says through the prophet, speaking to the exiles in Babylon, who now understood that their exile was punishment for their unfaithfulness. And now they couldn't believe that God would forgive them unconditionally. And forgiveness to them meant going home, going back to the land. They could not believe it. And then the words come, "My thoughts are not your thoughts. My ways are not your ways. And as far as the stars in the sky are from the earth, so God's ways are higher than our ways." And the verse is a reminder to me of the danger of being religious. Because it is so easy, and I know this in myself, and I can look back and see it, and even see it in myself today, is that we take what makes sense to us and what is orderly and reasonable, and we take our prejudices and our morals and our distinctions and our hierarchies, and then create a God to fit them, a God that condones them and supports them and justifies them. And how easily then we call this religion. And I see the Jesus of the Gospels. I still remember 5 years ago on Easter, we had a banner across there that said, "Jesus and his troublemaking go merrily on." Quote from Andrew Greeley. But Jesus came to make trouble and be mischievous about religion. The religion that finds a God to support human prejudice. And Jesus announces a God who is far, far different than the ways that we make up for our God. And the parable is an example. And in Jeremias, the New Testament scholar, he shows a parallel parable taught by a rabbi some centuries later, but may have come from the same source that Jesus got his story. Very similar story. The landowner went to call workers in the vineyard. Some came early and spent all day working, others in the middle of the day, and others at the end of the day and only worked 1 hour. And then when they came for their pay, everyone got the same. And those who had worked all day grumbled. And then the landowner said this, "The person that worked 1 hour got as much done in 1 hour as you did in all day." You know, that's comfortable. That fits in. How different Jesus' story is. The landowner being an image of God. What a day it must have been for those workers who worked all day, when they saw those in the front of the line that worked 1 hour getting as much as they were promised, and they probably said, "Wow, what kind of pay we will get if those people are getting this." And then they got up and they got exactly the same. And to those in that context who understood the parable, it must have been a big ouch, because they knew what Jesus was pointing to. It was their complaining about the way he had been showering love and mercy and acceptance and healing and meals and food and forgiveness on those who didn't deserve it. Tax collectors and prostitutes and the poor and the outcasts, the lame and the blind, those who were sick because of their sins, so it was thought. And Jesus was lavishing mercy upon them. And if they heard the story, they got it. They knew what he was talking about. And then he was so bold as to say, "This is the way God is." And then they'd have two choices: get rid of the storyteller or be converted by the story. And I see this story continue to live and continue to confront the ways we have our neat packages of how things are to be. The story lives and continues to call to question the ways that we would limit the mercy of God and make God exclusive and careful and rational and neat and very, very sane. And this happened to me. And I want to tell you now stories of two Holy Communions. And I think of this especially in the context of the children who will be sharing for the first time. Now, this story hit me right away because one of my first thoughts was, my goodness, I had to go through 3 years of confirmation before my first communion. Do you see any connection? Mm-hmm. 1970 to 75, I served a little congregation in San Diego, California. The church room wasn't any bigger than this room, so no one went unnoticed. I remember the first Sunday Brenda came. She was a fifth grader. Her parents were unchurched. She came with one of the families in our church. She came the next Sunday and the next Sunday and soon became part of the family, and everyone knew Brenda, and she loved the church. And she hadn't had First Communion instruction yet, so she came up for the blessing with joy and happiness every Sunday. And if there was anyone who became part of the family, it was Brenda. And I remember one Sunday before the Eucharist, Brenda came up to me and she said, my family's moving to the East Coast, I think it was New Jersey, and we're leaving this afternoon. And she looked up at me and she said, may I share communion on my last Sunday? And I looked down at her, and I really underscore the word down. By the way, this story has no happy endings. Don't. After a moment of silence, I heard these words come out of my mouth. You can't because you haven't had instruction yet. I looked into her eyes, and I saw in those eyes hurt and rejection, and saw behind those eyes a broken heart. And I turned and walked away to start the service. And I felt better because I explained to myself the very rational reasons why I had told her what I did, and they were very, very rational and justifiable. It wouldn't be fair to the other fifth graders who hadn't started their instruction yet or would have to take instruction. You know how kids are about being fair. And then church law. In our Lutheran church, unwritten, but it's there. We're not supposed to share with anyone who has not been properly instructed. And I remember how empty that communion was. And I have a prayer for Brenda. By now, she's probably the age of some of you, that somewhere she has found open hands. The justifications worked because I forgot about her until I started thinking more about Holy Communion, the Eucharist. And the thought came that this is not my table, this is not the pastor's table. This is the Lord's table. This is the table of Jesus. And I contemplated the meal sharing of Jesus. How Jesus broke the bread and gave it to the multitudes and was prodigal in his giving. And when I saw Jesus, I also saw Brenda's face again. Her face came back to me. And those hurt eyes came back to me, and she converted me. And it took her a long time. It took her a long time, and I wish someday I could tell her how she converted to me. This is the family table. And here's my prayer when I think of Brenda, and this isn't the closing prayer for the sermon. This is the midpoint prayer. Just in case you were thinking. When I think of today's parable and I think of her, I pray to God, help me to be almost as crazy as you are. Because God is demented in a way by human standards, insane. Because you throw the same wages at the 1 hour workers as you do at the 10 hour workers. You shower your mercy and your love, your whole creation you give to everyone, deserving and undeserving. And God, help me not to be, first of all, more moral or more doctrinally pure or more correct, but more crazy and more prodigal and more extravagant and less careful with your love and acceptance and your foolish ways of peace and forgiving and loving enemies and sharing. But Brenda prepared me for one of the most precious moments in my life. Now this is a happy story. In our congregation that I served in Albuquerque, we had an older member whose name was Blanche Van Essen. She was matronly and had great dignity. And when she entered the nursing home across the street from her church building, she lost none of her dignity. She was unable to attend services because of her health, so I went to her room and carried with me what I used to call the little black holy box, because you open it up and it has four little glasses and bread and wine to share with her Holy Communion. She asked me if her roommate could share too, and I said, sure. And before I left, Blanche said, next time you come, may I invite some more of the people to share? And I said, sure. And so the next time I went, we set a time so she knew when I was coming. I brought two holy boxes with eight little glasses. And I walked into the lobby or into the lounge, and I'll never forget the surprise. Blanche had set up a table, tablecloth, candles, and around the table, row after row of wheelchairs. She had invited everybody, and the ones that wouldn't come, she pushed them in. Some didn't even know where they were. She brought everyone, and then on the wall, I saw this sign that said, Protestant Communion, 4 o'clock Tuesday. So I saw Blanche in the middle, white-haired, matronly, proud, right in the middle of this traffic jam. I waded through the chairs, and I whispered to her, said, I only have two boxes with eight glasses. And she didn't even answer me, but she looked to everyone and announced, the pastor forgot something and will be back in 10 minutes. And I ran over to the church. By this time, holding my little boxes, I felt like it was the two loaves and the loaves and the fish. Blanche was Jesus. I returned, and we shared, and I remember the tears running down the cheeks of people. Talking to some of them afterwards, they told me how it had been years and years since the bread and the wine of the sacrament had touched their lips. They were forgotten people. And there were senile people there. And I think they thought they were getting their medication. And that's okay. It was more important spiritually for us to include them, for them to know what was going on. And I'd like to say that again. It was more important spiritually for us to include them and for them to know what was going on. Before I left for Holden, they shipped in pennies and nickels and gave me a pair of mountain socks. And those are holy. And both eyes. And I have a way when I see those socks to pray this prayer. God, if there's a day of judgment, may my sin be one of being too extravagant with your mercy and your gifts. Well, these stories leads me to what I think is a new chapter in this story, and that's today. We're a family, brothers and sisters, and now three sisters in Christ. We will no longer pass the bread over them or around them, but we'll share with them. And I'd say to Tasha and Claire and Karen, we need you because we can't really be a family meal without you. And you help us see the kingdom. Because Jesus said, let the children come to me. To such belongs the kingdom. Unless you become as a child, you will not enter the kingdom. And Jesus took the children in his arms. And he blessed them. When we studied together, we learned about baptism and how baptism is our birth into this family to share this family meal. Several years ago, as a matter of conscience, in relation to what we saw as the out-of-control arms race, Karen and I made a decision to become tax resistors, meaning to withhold part of our tax and not willingly pay that part of the tax in light of the massive arms buildup. And part of the commitment of doing this was one, to let people know, but at the same time never to communicate the attitude that others have to do this or that we're better than others, but to say this is a way that our conscience has led us. Now, when one makes a stand, probably the most common verse that comes from people that have serious questions about this is the words of Jesus, give to Caesar what is Caesar's. And for that reason, it was very tempting in a sermon tonight to give a 10-15 minute defense. And I have a happy, joyful note to tell you, I resisted that temptation. Instead, I want to share as well as I can what I believe Jesus was meaning when he said, give to Caesar what is Caesar's and to God what is God's. And what we decided to do, the possibility of the Christian making that decision, if it's not obvious from just sharing from this text, then I'll try again sometime. The normal interpretation of this give to Caesar what is Caesar's and to God what is God's is that there are simply two spheres of life, the sphere of Caesar and the sphere of God. And Caesar's sphere has to do with government, politics, war making, law. And then God's realm over here has to do with church, worship, liturgy, and sacraments and personal morality. And the two spheres are neatly divided. And our task is to figure out what the two realms are and then keep them very separate. This is a normal interpretation, and the consequences of this have been tragic, especially as the German church did nothing to oppose the rise of Hitler, because that was not God's sphere. That was another sphere. I think the church in wisdom, and once in a while I'll say the church lacks wisdom, and here I'll say the church had great wisdom, and that was to choose the first lesson to go with the gospel. And now I'll explain why. First lesson is from the writing of an unknown, unnamed preacher during the Babylonian captivity. Faithful Jews longed to be delivered from this new Egypt of Babylon. And this preacher sees Yahweh as reaching down, as it were, and anointing a Messiah. And the word in the text is Cyrus, my Messiah, a deliverer. Messiah, it's Cyrus, the king of Persia. And he doesn't even know who Yahweh is. And yet Yahweh says, you will be my new Moses. For Cyrus will defeat the Babylonians and let the people go home. Now, what the preacher here proclaims to very pious Jews in Babylon is this: I have good news of a Zoroastrian Messiah. I have good news of an Iranian deliverer, an Iranian or a Persian Moses. And I think we have to understand this was terribly offensive to pious Jews in Babylon. And you can see the severe criticism is evident in Isaiah 45. That God would pick as a beloved servant someone from beyond the sphere of our organized religion. Now, I'm going to stop my sermon here and kind of slip this in. And then after I say this, I'll go back to the sermon. This is kind of an extra special treat. You don't have to laugh. I think when Cyrus is mentioned as God's Messiah, God's anointed, this one who would be a pagan out of the realm of organized religion as they saw it, I think tonight's a special night to celebrate how God has used both in the world and in this Holden community, people because of integrity choose not to be part of the specific intentional Christian community. And when I think of the years at Holden, I think how my life here has been touched by those who have been in this community that some would say are outside. And I think in the whole world, I think God chose someone outside of our faith to teach more about what Jesus is about to our age than anybody else. And that is when God, I think, anointed Gandhi of India to teach the world the way of Jesus Christ. And I want tonight partly to be a celebration of those people. Remember an old seminary professor I had, his name was Yelmer Johnson. He was so old when he taught, he could hardly walk. And he used to tell us the church is like a ranch, has a fence around it. And if anybody ever comes along who is outside of the fence, we just move the fence out. And I like that, and I'll never forget that. So part of tonight, I think, is a celebration of Cyrus and all the Cyruses that we know and have come to this earth. Now back to the text. Now it's clear in the Cyrus passage, there is not a sphere of Cyrus and a sphere of Yahweh. There is only one sphere, only one realm, only one kingdom, only one king, and that king is Yahweh, who reaches down and anoints Cyrus to do God's work. And if this is the biblical notion, and I believe it is, then what does Jesus mean by give to Caesar what is Caesar's, and to God what is God's? Now, let's try to listen to the story again. In the context of Matthew, tension has been mounting between Jesus and those who oppose him. And Jesus has just told several stories that hit at their hypocrisy and their refusal to believe. And now two groups band together. The Pharisees, we know them, and they get together with the Herodians. These are the ultra-conservative, pro-Roman collaborators with the Roman oppression. Normally, these two groups would hate each other. The Pharisees were anti-Romans, the Herodians pro-Roman. But now they come together, and after phony niceties, They ask the trick question, is it right to pay taxes to Caesar or not? And Jesus knows their intent and the trick. If he says yes, he'll lose the people. If he says no, don't pay taxes, the Herodians will report him and he'll be arrested. It's a trick question. And what Jesus does is he says, show me a coin used for paying the tax. And possibly something very humorous happens here. They quick pull out a coin. And then all the people that are standing around get a big smile on their faces because here a Pharisee has been carrying one of these coins. Mm-hmm. And the coin has an idol on it, the very image of Tiberius Caesar, and it is written under his image, the majestic son of the majestic God. And no Jew is to carry this coin. And Jesus says, show me a coin, and they're so anxious to trick him that they pull one out. You get it? And then Jesus, probably with kind of a dry humor, says, whose picture is that on there? And they say, Caesar's. And then I think this is the intent of what he says. And now these coins were minted only to pay taxes for no other reason. He says, if that little hunk of metal belongs to the person whose picture or image is on there, well, give it to him. But give to God what is God's. Okay, now the question, what is God's? Now, I think here's an interpretation that makes sense to me. Jesus had a specific reason, I think, to point to the fact there was an image on that coin. Because the fact that there was that image meant that the coin belonged to Caesar. And then when he turned right away and said, give to God what is God's, any Jew who knew Scripture would immediately think of Genesis. The human being is created in the image of God, meaning every human being, as that coin has Caesar stamped on it, every human being has God stamped on that person's life. And so Jesus is not giving a mini lecture on church and state, but Jesus is doing what Jesus always does. When he says, give to God's what is God's, he's talking about you and me, that we are stamped with the image of God. And we are to give our whole selves to the one to whom we belong, if we would be truly human. And so Jesus is doing what he always does, calling humans to give up all other loyalties, all other priorities, and seek God and God alone, and give ourselves to the one whose image we bear. Now notice, the Pharisees and the Herodians leave right away. They can't get out of there fast enough because they have been confronted with truth. They have been confronted with the claim of God on their lives. And what they really wanted was a bull session about church and state. And that's what we've been using this passage for ever since, is to have bull sessions on church and state to avoid being confronted by the living word. And I call that, as my class is called in winter program, BS sessions. I think that's what I heard it's called. That's Bible survey. We'd rather sit around intellectualizing church and state issues when Jesus here is talking to us about dying. And no wonder they left him alone and went away. He was talking about their dying to their idolatries and their self-pride and their privilege and being raised as new beings, fully human, sharing fully in the divine life. And we humans have been doing that ever since, running away from Jesus, walking away. It's threatening. This warning is on every cigarette ad and every cigarette package. I don't know if you've read one lately. They say, warning, the Surgeon General has determined that cigarette smoking is dangerous to your health. Now, I'm not going to have another little sermon here about smoking. But I thought when I read this, maybe every time we read the gospel story of Jesus, we should have a little sign that says, warning, thousands of saints and martyrs have determined that hearing the gospel and not running away is dangerous to old ways of life. And it may be dangerous to life itself. Danger, risk. And think of those that we commemorate today. Martin of Tours, age 20, on his way up in the Roman army, he was baptized and said, I cannot kill if I am a follower of Christ. And he received the criticism that probably almost every CO receives, that you're a coward, that you're not a man, that you're afraid to fight. We're told that he went into the next battle without any weapons, just to show that he was not a coward. But he stands as the one that took the risk of following, and his whole life became that risk. But think of Soren Kierkegaard. Faith called him to live and write, protesting the phoniness of 19th century Danish society, the coldness and sterility of the official Christian church. He's honored today in almost every philosophy department of every university. But he was ridiculed. Even Soren was a popular Danish name until he came along, and then nobody ever named their kids that again. There were two people at his funeral. One was his brother, who was buried in an unmarked grave. Soren. One thing he said I'll never forget in reading Kierkegaard. He said of the Danish church, you love to admire Jesus, but you do not follow Jesus. You're admirers and not followers. Give to God what is God's. Follow what you admire. Now I think of the Holden community, and I think of people, and I think of people here, people who have come through this place, and offer a thanks and a prayer that this will always be, that this place will not be only a place of intellectual debating and going back and forth, but it will always be a place where the living word of the living Christ challenges us and calls us to die. And how that has happened and how people have gone from this place, touched by that, how there have been life changes, job changes, the end really of fitting in, the end of normalcy, jail for some, resistance in many ways. And that life out there may mean giving the little coin to Caesar, or it may be a time to withhold it. Where will this lead us all? The future is unknown. It is risk. But we begin the journey. And I think those who have followed this journey would say, and I think Martin of Tours would say this, Soren would say this, I wouldn't trade this life to be this one with this one, Jesus of Nazareth. To their experience in the deepest way what it means to be human in the image of God. Now we give homage to the one who is the Lord of one kingdom, the King of the universe, in the hymn, Beautiful Savior. I'd like to begin by sharing a few words, and the purpose of a homily occasionally being at the very, very beginning of a service, that instead of it being an explanation of the text, It's a way to say a few words to set the tone and the mood for our whole worship experience. So I'd begin this way. How much I think Thanksgiving relates to memories. Think of the shared memories that all of us have of this day. You can think back, you can smell the smells of Thanksgiving. You can remember waking up in the morning and already the smell of the turkey. You remember family together. You remember the time you were stuck in the snow and never made it to the family Thanksgiving dinner. There's also times when Thanksgivings have been sad and have been lonely. Many things we pull together that are memories for us this day. I'd like to share one memory that really came home to me last night during Vespers, and that's when we talked about the booth behind us. It's from the Jewish festival of booths. One thing I'm thankful for that my experience of being a parish pastor in Albuquerque is we shared our building with a Jewish school. They rented our Sunday church school rooms during the week, and so all during the week we shared space with Jewish people in the same building. Most interesting was meetings that we had between with Lutherans and Jewish people there together to work things out, because we each brought what we're good at, they being blunt and we being nice. I just couldn't believe how nice we were. And part of, or one of the joys because of that, they did just very special things for us to say thank you to us. And one of those happenings was on a Sunday morning. We knew about this and announced it during the Eucharist on Sunday morning that it was the Jewish Festival of Booths, and they erected a booth in our churchyard. And then after services, we walked out into the yard, and then we all gathered around the booth, and the Jewish people explained to us the meaning of the festival, and then invited us into the booth, and we shared wine and other goodies and cookies and all kinds of food with them. It was a beautiful day, and it was a day that I remember and give thanks. And that memory came back to me last night that I think that all we have to do is understand why Jewish people set up this booth once a year for us to understand what Thanksgiving is. And it's simply this, and if you're in winter program, this has been said over and over, that wherever a Jewish person goes on this earth, whether or not that's in a city or on a farm or in crowded conditions or any place, a booth is put up once a year to remind Jewish people of the wilderness and to remind them of those roots, and then to remind them especially that wherever we go in this world, and I'm going to say we now because we share that heritage, wherever we go in this world, our lesson and our identity comes from the wilderness. And that means that life basically is precarious, life basically is risk, and we come into life with nothing, and as in the wilderness where God gave the manna, everything that comes to us is a gift. We deserve nothing. We're entitled to nothing. We earn nothing. Everything is a gift. And then the reminder from the wilderness that the gift of God was a gift to be shared. No one had too much, and no one had too little. And so never is Thanksgiving a time to offer thanks for our excess, but it's to offer thanks that God meets our needs and then calls us that God may be helped in sharing the gift to those who do not have enough. This is being a Thanksgiving people. This is Eucharistic living. Everything is a gift. Nothing is deserved. and the gift is for everyone. And so we celebrate the Eucharist as a ritual on this Thanksgiving Day, and it's a picture. The gift comes from God, and the gift is received, and thanksgiving is offered, and the gift is shared. So it's in that context now that we offer our praise and our thanksgiving, that we deserve nothing. It's all free and it's all given. And now we sing our song and give thanks. Quote from Walter Brueggemann about the first Sunday in Advent. Advent does not begin in buoyancy or celebration or in a shopping spree. The natural habitat of Advent is a community of hurt. It is the voice, or Advent is the voice, of those who know profound grief, who articulate it, and do not cover it over. My memory goes back to PLU, Harstead Hall. It was called Old Main at that time. My roommate and I lived on the second floor. We were sophomores. Did you all know I went to PLU? Oh, surprise. Some. My roommate Dave and I were studying very late, and there was a knock on the door. And I opened the door. And it was my brother Phil, who was a senior that year, in tears. And he came into the room, sat down in a chair, and just sobbed and sobbed. And I remember Dave and I kneeling on either side of Phil and just hugging him as he cried. And we found out what was wrong. Dee, Phil's fiance, wasn't sure that she loved him and needed a few days. And those few days were very, very long. And we spent hours together, and I think my brother Phil and I became much closer those days because there was nothing to do. There was nothing we could do but wait, and share hurt and wait. And that's Advent. I should say these stories always don't turn out right, but Dee, the person in the story, is my sister-in-law of the last 23 years. Was also a very dear friend over the years. Advent, it's feeling those hurts of the present day and crying out for a new day. Advent is hard. But we need Advent because before we can celebrate Christmas with unrestrained joy, we need to feel the hurt and the need and the emptiness, the unfulfillment, the despair and the darkness, all the things to which God responded by becoming flesh, by becoming Emmanuel, God with us. We first need to feel those before we celebrate the incarnation. We first need to feel those before we celebrate the incarnation. And that's hard in our society. Think of our society in the many ways it says do, 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 do. And Advent says, do nothing but wait. Or a society that tries to tell us you are full, you're better off now than you were 4 years ago. You are full. You are rich. And then Advent comes and says, you are empty. Or I think a society that encourages us to be numb, encourages us not to feel, And then Advent comes and now calls us to feel and to feel deeply, to feel hurt. First, the hurt of our Old Testament ancestors as they cried for Emmanuel. Then I think Advent is to feel my hurt, my own pain, the fears and the emptiness and the loneliness inside of me. And then, but to go there and to extend that to feeling for this community, for us, for you. And think of those around you here in our room. Think of dreams shattered. Think of relationships of the past that have been broken, promises that have not been kept, the resulting pain. Think of the loneliness that has been shared here, life disappointments, fear of the future. What are we going to do when we leave this place? Think of all of our hurts. And Advent is to reach out and share that pain among us, but then to go beyond this community and nation. And we've done that as we think of Rolf and his friends. We heard today of Gertrude's family. We've heard of Herb and Corinne Chilstrom in Minnesota, the loss of their son. It's to reach out and feel deeply for them, and then for the homeless and the hungry and the unemployed, the children, battered children who are afraid to tell anybody but cry by themselves. And how we who are men need to feel the pain of women, and you've helped us. And all of us here who are white, how we need to feel the pain of people of color in this country. We who are outside the prisons, the pain of those who are inside. And then to move out to the world, to Africa and to its famine, to refugees, to the hungry and the oppressed, to Central America, to Namibia, all over. And then to move from there to the very pain of nature. Creation as it groans under the weight of our pollution, our exploitation, and our greed. And remember what Paul said, that all creation groans as it waits for deliverance. Then I believe when we have felt, and what a task, what a call to feel this deeply. But when we do, then we can hear all of the cries together, my cry, your cry, this community's cry, the world's cry, nature's cry. And all of them together make the choir that is Advent. God, come. A whole universe in birth pangs, waiting and waiting for the birth of a new age. And Advent is to join that choir and to cry, come. Advent is hurt and feeling that hurt, but Advent is hope. This is the first time in Holden that I kept running into the winter and realized you can run on the snow, and Bob and Julia have been helping me, and we run down to 10 Mile Creek Bridge, and some of you know I like to look at shapes and things, and every day to watch 10 Mile Creek getting smaller and smaller and smaller until seeing it yesterday, it's gone. Did you know that? It's all covered with ice and snow. But I'd like to share with you something that I know about 10 Mile Creek. There is still water running under there. And I know it, and I'm sure. And I think I'm more sure than I'm sure the whole universe is going to turn out okay. But that I struggle with, and that I proclaim tonight too. And in spring, that water will break forth. And how I think under the ice of the pain and hurt and greed and oppression of this world, under that ice is the God energy that flows quietly. It's grace energy, it's love power, it's Christ flowing. And in the midst of the hurt, it has a way of bubbling up and breaking into life. And Advent is to be ready for those little breakthroughs. And then to know that that river is flowing and someday will break through into a mighty river that will cover the universe. And there will be shalom for this universe. And I know that that little river of grace is flowing because I heard a story about a resurrection. And it's helped me to believe that this river is flowing underneath and is bubbling forth and will eventually cover the earth to meet people of hope. And some of you remember with me Zephania Kamita, the Namibian vice president of the Evangelical Lutheran Church. And the one story I'll never forget that he told us, he was in Amsterdam, and a white student came up to him and said, "Do you really believe Namibia will be free?" Remember that question? And his answer was a smile, I believe. And he asked this student, "Will the sun rise tomorrow morning? Will the sun rise tomorrow morning?" The Namibians are called prisoners of hope. That's what they call themselves, bound by hope. And they teach us what Mark's gospel teaches us. There's really two kinds of people in Namibia today, I think. Those who are ready for God and those who are not. Those who are not are the white people who run the apartheid system and the black people who have submitted to them and reap the personal benefits. And then when Zephania was here, we learned about SWAPO and how in the refugee camps in Angola and among the SWAPO people in Namibia, what are they doing? They're getting ready to run a nation. They're practicing. They're learning the economics. They're learning the skills that they will need to have their own government, prisoners of hope. And when the Christ energy breaks through the ice of that oppression, it is those who are tied to the old dying order that will be running like bugs for cover when the light comes out. It's those who are already in Namibia practicing the new order that will be ready to celebrate and rejoice and to live with it. And a message to us, as unity and love and liberation break out in little ways in this world, and then when the final liberation comes, which Christian symbolism has called the second coming of Christ, it's those who have latched themselves onto the old order, the order of human power and war-making and wealth, that will not be ready. But who will be ready? Those whose lives are in tune, already living and practicing the way of the new age. And that life is a gift. So watch, be ready. You do not know the day nor the hour of God's little surprises or the big surprise, the new age. We watch and we're called to be ready. Amen. Tonight in the sermon, I will do something I was taught not to do. Because we were taught that it's what Catholics do. And we're not to do it. Because I remember learning very early that if Catholics do it, it's wrong. And tonight I'm going to do it, and that's exalt and praise Mary, whom Luther called the Mother of God. Tonight is a night to praise her and honor her and lift her up as an example. I remember Bible studies about Mary when I was a child and also a teenager. You'd go through the Bible and try to find everything wrong with Mary. And then the conclusion of the Bible study was, well, she's a miserable sinner like all the rest of us. And the only way she is an example is that she too must depend on the mercy of God. Do you remember ever a Bible study like that? It was trying to make Mary into a good Lutheran. Tonight, I will do not what we used to do as Lutherans, or not what sometimes piety of other traditions have done, but try to exalt Mary as Luke does. For Luke lifts Mary up as the first of the disciples, the model disciple, the one who is the example of what it means to be a disciple, and I think the example of what it means to be ready for Christmas. It's less than 24 hours now when we break into the rejoicing of the season of Christmas, the feast of the Incarnation, and Advent closes. In these final hours now, we focus on Mary and ask, what does she teach us about being ready for the coming of Jesus? The beauty of Luke's portrayal of Mary and the angel. The angel appears, "Hail Mary," or "Rejoice," or "Peace be with you, Mary. You have found favor with God." And Mary is troubled. And the angel says, "Don't be afraid." Then these astonishing words, "You will conceive and bear a son. The child will be the Son of the Most High God. The child will be the King of Israel, carry on his ancestor David's throne. His kingship will last forever, and he will fulfill the promise that God made to King David, an eternal kingdom." And Mary's response, "How can this be when I have no husband?" Then two astonishing statements by the angel, "The Holy Spirit will come upon you, and the power of the Most High God will overshadow you." Now I want to just share underneath these two statements. The first is creation language. The Holy Spirit will come upon you. The memory is Genesis, the formless void before creation was made. And the Spirit hovered over the void and brought forth the creation. And now the angel says, just as that happened, the Spirit now will hover again over the void of your womb and will bring forth a whole new creation. And then God will overshadow you. This is Mount Sinai language. Remember the mountain and Moses going for the covenant, and the cloud of God came and covered the mountain. And there around the mountain, a people was birthed to be the people of God. And the angel says, out of your womb I bring another Mount Sinai. A new people is birthed. The Holy Spirit is beginning a whole new thing. Now, the normal response to this would probably be that of Sarah,
laughter.
Remember when Sarah heard she was going to have a child when she was in her upper 90s? She rolled over laughing. She did what we would do. You gotta be kidding. You gotta be kidding. But Mary does not. Mary says, I am the servant of Yahweh, and let it be done to me as you have spoken. Mary says, I give my body to bear God into the world and to bear this new creation and to bring forth this new people. Now, I ask this question and invite you to ask a question because I think it's significant for all of us. Why was Mary ready for the big surprise so she didn't even laugh and didn't even say, you got to be kidding? When it came, she's not shocked, but she believes and she offers herself. Some say Mary was probably about 14. And I was thinking of 14-year-old girls, 14-year-old girls I've known, mostly in confirmation classes. This is the age of Lutheran confirmation classes. And I close my eyes and think of them, boys and girls, nervously giggling, worrying about what the other kids will think of them, like I did when I was 13. Nervously establishing identity with the group. Do you remember? But I remember in 15 years of teaching confirmation classes, one or two girls that were Marys. They were very, very different. I would see them there listening to every word that was said and staying after class and asking questions about God and about faith and about justice and peace and about the world. And I look back and I say, these were the Marys. Mary was like this. Why was Mary ready? I think that she had thought so deeply about God and how God works. She knew that God does not work in normal ways. She knew the history of her people. When God wanted to get a people started, he didn't go to some healthy young couple, but to an old couple in their 90s to get it all started. When God wanted to bring forth a people, he didn't go to some great people on earth. He went to a bunch of slaves in Egypt. When God wanted to bring forth a great king, he went to the lowly shepherd boy, David, whose greatest task at that time was to bring sandwiches to his brothers. And God anointed that one king. Mary knew the stories and knew that this God is a God of surprises. That any time and any place, this God can break in again and do another weird thing that shocks all our human notions about the way God should be and about the way things should be. Mary knew this. And so I think, or in my thinking, Mary was ready to accept the child, the task, the lowly manger, the shepherds, the foreigners. And then finally she was ready to accept the cross, the throne of this king, to share the pain of the cross, pondering all these things in her heart and knowing very deeply that God works with strange surprises and God would finally redeem the world. It's through weakness and suffering. Maybe Mary was the first to understand the mystery that Paul talks about in Romans, of a new age and a new people brought forth by suffering and by a cross. Well, now how this speaks to me. Christmas, we celebrate the coming of God. And tonight, I'm reminded, and we're all reminded, how easy it could be to miss Christmas. I mean, the depth of Christmas, which is God comes into the world. Because we're all so normal. We expect God to be normal like we think things should be normal. And if any one of us are going to think about the great problems of this world, whether it's hunger or the arms race or what, and if we're looking to the great, powerful world leaders that someday they're all going to get it together and solve the problem, and there God is going to work, I think we'll miss it. The preparation for God's comings will not be in Time magazine. We'll miss it. It's going to be weird. The way God comes into the deepest problems of this world or into our lives, or the way God finally comes. Close, I want to share a little story. It's a story that almost every year gets me ready for Christmas, and it'll fit this theme of the surprises of God. It's simply the story of a Charlie Chaplin movie, City Lights. Charlie Chaplin, the tramp, the outcast, the vagabond, saves a rich man from drowning. And they develop a relationship, and whenever the rich man is drunk, he loves Charlie. When he's sober, he can't stand him. Once, when he's drunk, he gives Charlie Chaplin, the little tramp, all kinds of money. And then, when he becomes sober, he calls the police and accuses Charlie Chaplin of stealing the money. And the little tramp runs to a woman who is blind that he has befriended, quickly gives her the money, and she takes the money and has an operation that restores her sight. And the police catch the vagabond, throw him in prison. And for years, he's in prison, and he's finally released, shabbier and lonelier than ever. He goes back to the woman who's now running a successful floral shop, and she does not recognize him, for she imagined that her benefactor was tall and handsome and rich. And she ridicules him, and he trudges by the floral shop, and she laughs at him. The one who went to prison and gave the money for her sight. In the final scene, she touches his arm, and then she feels his face, and she whispers, "You. It's you." Are we ready to stop standing in awe before what is so handsome and beautiful and impressive and in control, and walk into the barn? Let's close our eyes and touch the child and say, "God, it's you. It's you." And then are we ready to stand next to that Roman soldier who looked at Jesus dying on the cross and he said, "God, it's you. It's you." Oh God, make us ready for the surprise of Jesus Christ and for all the surprises you have in store for us and for this world. May we see. Amen. I'm a human being. And like all humans, I think we like to live with unquestionable assumptions. It gets life neat and orderly. An epiphany, meaning manifestation, is a celebration of God's mischievous work of shattering our old assumptions and breaking in with truth. Epiphany is a way that we see not by a long rational process of reading the right essay, but it's that aha, that vision, that wow, I see it. Now, in the ancient Roman world, there was an unquestionable assumption, and that is that Jews and Gentiles, who are very different, ought to be separated from one another, and they were separated. And it was right, and it was considered good, and each despised the other. Separation was a foregone conclusion between these two peoples in the Roman world. The majority, Romans, Gentiles, and the minority, Jews, who we are told made up about 10% of the Roman Empire. They looked down on each other and would not mingle and would not associate with one another, until the gospel of Jesus began to go into the Roman world. And people had epiphanies. The manifestation that a divided people can be one family. And it started to happen. Little communities of people worshiping in homes. Jews and Gentiles together breaking bread. Unthinkable, but it was happening. Scholars tell us that Matthew was very possibly written to house churches in Palestine. House churches that were ridiculed by both Jews and Gentiles, because Jews and Gentiles in those houses shared life together and ate together. And look at what the Epiphany Gospel portrays to them. Now the birth of Jesus took place in this way. And we're brought into the room where Jesus now is staying. And here we have a very Jewish baby. We have a very Jewish mother. And Matthew is careful to explain to us that Joseph was not only a Jew, but a very good Jew, a very devout Jew. And into this room walk 17 Gentiles. And remember, the only reason I say 17 is because Matthew doesn't say 3 either. Okay. But I like to think of the room as just filled with these magi from the East. And they were not only normal Gentiles. We think they were probably Zoroastrian astrologers that might even had pointed hats with stars and moons on them. And they come and together with Mary, and we assume Joseph, they adore the Christ child. And I think the first who heard the gospel of Matthew would have said this, wow, we see that the Jews and Gentiles together in our family is the very purpose of God. And this story prefigured or predicted what is now happening in our midst. And it's what the book of Ephesians says about the mystery of God now revealed in the church. This was descriptive of the church, the very mystery of God, that God would bring together the diverse peoples of this world into one family, is now happening. And where is it happening? In a little group of people meeting in a living room of a home, sharing bread and wine. Now the prayer for this day. Lord, make me an epiphany person. And the opposite of that prayer is, Lord, preserve me from being like the chief priests and the scribes, the religious leaders in this story. So set on the way things are that they had no eyes to see the dawning of a new day. They sent the Magi on their way and then got back to normal business. It helps me to understand Epiphany by remembering an Epiphany person. And that's what I'd like to do now. A person that has touched my life, and I know has touched the lives of other people in this room, and I know has especially touched the lives of the Witt family, and that person is Joseph Sittler. Now is blind or practically blind in his 80s. Professor, University of Chicago, probably the grandfather of Lutheran theologians in our country. Once when I lived in San Diego, I got to go and hear Joseph Sittler speak. And I never have missed an opportunity when I could. And there were only about 15 of us there, so we sat in a circle. And instead of giving us a lecture, he just told the story of his life. And I'd like to repeat as much as I can remember. Joseph Sittler grew up as a Lutheran in a Lutheran parsonage that was very Lutheran. But he was lucky, and especially St. Olaf people, listen to this. He was lucky that his upbringing was not too narrow because he was introduced very early to literature. And I don't know if you know this, but most great writers are not Lutherans. Is that right? Are any great writers Lutherans? Well, never mind. You know, and I think of my own upbringing, that which was very, very Lutheran, and how thankful I am that my parents were very serious about exposing me to music and art. You know, and it's the same thing. Most artists aren't Lutherans, and it was the door, I think, that opened me to new worlds that were not Lutheran. Well, Joseph Sittler became a Lutheran pastor and entered into the radical step of Lutheran unity, realizing that all Lutherans are one, and they can be together. His work in Lutheranism was recognized, so he became a representative of Lutheranism in the ecumenical movement and in the World Council of Churches. And there, aha, he discovered the unity of all Christians. Protestant, Orthodox, Roman Catholic, all Christians are one. He discovered that unity. And then he went on to tell the next epiphany, that being part of the World Council of Churches, he was brought into contact with people of other living faiths, Buddhists and Hindus, Muslims, Jewish people. And in dialogue with them, aha, a deep sense of the unity of all religions, of the living religions, and then through that, the unity of the whole human race. And then he told us where I am at the present when he was speaking to us. And to see a great mind as that mind expands. He says, now I see, and I know more deeply, the unity of all things in creation. The unity of the human with the animals and the rocks and the earth and with the stars. And how we're made of the same stuff as the stars. And how we're all one. And I think maybe at that point he was close to the Magi, who by deep intuition, sensitivity, knew the connections of humans with the very stars in the sky. and knew the connection of the stars in the sky with that baby that was lying there in that bed in that room in Bethlehem. And they broke in to a Jewish family and together there adored the Christ child. Epiphanies. And you know, they're scary and they're threatening. Maybe what I've said to you is scary because you might say, are you destroying the uniqueness of Jesus Christ and Christianity as the true religion in this world? And that's threatening. And one thing that I see in Joseph Sittler, the more he has seen the universalism and the unity of all things, I think the more deeply he has been incorporated into Jesus Christ and into the church. How? I can't speak for him. I'll speak for myself. How do I see a vision of the unity of all creation and still go to a Lutheran church on the corner of such and such? Are you ready for this? Okay. And to answer that for myself, I take you to the nation of India. We know from the last weeks what a fragile nation this is, where Muslims and Hindus live side by side, where there is deep suspicion, there is hatred that so easily can turn into violence between the two groups. One time in our century, Hindus and Muslims in India were seeking reconciliation and leaving hatred behind. One very special time. Why? A frail little man was lying in bed day after day, fasting, suffering, absorbing suffering for the sake of reconciliation of Muslims and Hindus. And the story that inspired his suffering for them was the story of Jesus. And the deep truth of that story, that the unity of all humans and of all creation comes about not by inflicting suffering, but by absorbing suffering. And Gandhi entered into the very pain of Jesus. And I read that during the fast, a non-Christian newspaper in India drew a cartoon of Gandhi with a Hindu in one knee and a Muslim on the other knee, and behind him the cross of Jesus Christ. And when Gandhi died, Muslim people marched through the streets with pictures of Gandhi with the cross of Jesus Christ behind him. I am a Christian because the world needs that story. And the world needs to never lose that story, that it is by the suffering love of God and the suffering of others who will follow Christ, absorbed into that suffering, by this way the world will be united. The world needs that story, and I commit myself to the community that will pass it on. And now we see the story in the breaking of bread. And if in that breaking, and I would encourage you tonight to not be looking at the hymnal, but to look at the bread as it is torn apart. It's picture language. To repeat again Sunday after Sunday that it is the brokenness of life through which the unity comes. And every time we see that bread broken, we can have an epiphany. Ah. It's not by some great army or great power on this earth, but it is by brokenness. Wow. Aha. epiphanies, light, and may we be people of that light. The choir will sing now about that light as a response to the proclamation.